Welcome, welcome, welcome. Left Reckoning 144, Ibram Kendi, Corporate Anti-Racism with Jason Miles. David Griscom here. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Matt will be in just a moment. Apologies for the late start. We're having a little bit of a tech issue getting Jason's conversation uploaded in time, but it'll be up here. It was a really great talk. Jason's piece in Damage Magazine, which you can find links below to catch, is really worth reading. He talks about, obviously, Ibram Kendi, but about this kind of, let's call it the anti-racism for the corporate suite. And we start talking about some of the real roots of suffering and discrimination in this country in depth with Jason, and they'll be going live in just a little bit. But before we get there, there's a couple of things that we wanted to note. One, if you missed it, over the weekend, Matt and I released our final installment on the Communist Manifesto. Yes, friends, we're diving into all of that kind of stuff. We're reading the dangerous texts. We're having fun. That's up there for patrons. You can get access to that at patreon.com/leftreckoning. These Mark's reading series are something that I'm really thrilled to be able to put out there for y'all. We do always try to make sure that they're available to the public eventually, but we want to make sure our patrons are getting access to that first, because y'all help us keep doing this program, and we appreciate all of y'all so much. So if you haven't seen it and you're a patron, check it out. It's already up there. And if you're not a patron, maybe it's a good time to sign up and get access to our conversation on the Communist Manifesto, which, you know, I'll just say this, critical text, very accessible, and I'm always surprised at how little it's oftentimes sort of grappled with people on the left. It's definitely worth your time. And I think we did a pretty good damn job at setting up an introduction to that. But as we're getting all that set up for our conversation with Jason Miles in just a little bit, I wanted to talk about a couple of things. First of all, as people probably know, there was a pretty horrific pro-genocide march that happened in DC. And none other than Van Jones spoke at it. And if y'all don't know who Van Jones is, particularly our younger audience, you might forget that Van Jones was a character. I think Matt's joining us right now. What's up, Matt?
Howdy. Van Jones is a character. Yeah, he's quite a character.
Van Jones is a character. Well, I was just saying, the thing that's funny about Van Jones, Matt, is, you know, back in the day, sorry, I'm trying to get us that. There we go. Double screen. Van Jones, when Obama first got elected to be president of the USA, there are all these wild conspiracy theories about Van Jones. You know, he's a secret Maoist. He's a communist revolutionary who's going to usher in a workers' utopia. Surprise, surprise, all those right wingers like Glenn Beck and a lot of them were wrong. But even wronger, I think, than they even intended to, or I think anyone with any common sense would have thought at the time. I mean, Van Jones is honestly the perfect encapsulation of somebody who might have had some kind of radical credentials back in the day, who gets completely eaten up and chewed out by the blob.
Usually what happens, and you see this a few times, like David Brooks as a social democrat at some conference when he's like 25 years old.
Yes, sir.
Like,
no, he was in SDS. You know that? He was
right, SDS. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it's like,
Students for Democratic Society, for people who don't know what that is. Yeah, sorry.
When that sort of thing happens, it's... And they're not, and you look back later in life and they're working for the New York Times or CNN, for instance, what that tells you is they were into politics. Yes, as kids. But ultimately, they were more into like a career in politics than maybe political values. It's pretty easy to see that happen. I don't know. It's not such a big mystery.
Well, with all those figures, you do wonder, like, you know, okay, so yeah, they take the devil's deal, right? And they're like, okay, I'm going to take whatever positions I have to take to have influence and be in the room, right? But you always wonder sometimes if they have, like, that moment where they're like, oh, fuck. You know what I mean? Like, what have I done? Who have I surrounded myself with? And I don't think that he necessarily has this moment. I don't know if you've seen this clip yet, man. But here's a pretty good encapsulation.
Oh, this was going to be the cold open, I think.
Okay, well then, good.
Is this a ceasefire? No ceasefire,
yes, sir.
Champ?
Yeah, yes, okay. Sir. Yeah. You know, I think this is a moment that, like, if you ever find yourself, look, life is long. You can always come back. Van Jones, if you want to come back, you know, come back. we might have to haze you for a little bit, but you could come back and join the right side of history. This is Van Jones speaking at the pro-genocide rally. He's trying to make, I think, a very basic, I'm not particularly impressed by it, but it's just amazing to see how this very basic humanitarian call is responded to at the rally.
Yeah.
I'm a peace guy. I pray for peace. No more rockets from Gaza and no more bombs falling down on the people of Gaza. God protect the children. God protect children. Let's end all the horror and all the heartbreak in the Holy Land. Let's end all of it. Let's end all of it. But I'll be honest in closing. When I think about what's happening over there, I don't feel powerful to do something about what's happening over there. What I do feel powerful is to maybe do something about what's happening here. Let's take a stand here against anti-Jewish bigotry. Let's take a stand against Muslim. Let's take a stand here against hatred. Let's take.
So for people who, you know, it's a little muddled, but what is going on in the crowd right there is people are chanting, no ceasefire, no ceasefire, no ceasefire. So again, anyone who's saying it's like, oh, you know, the golden Meyer quote, you know, this one, Matt, former PM of,
they don't exist.
Well, that's a nasty one. She's got a rogues gallery.
Yeah, you know, it's a horrible nasty person. One.
But she has this quote that people oftentimes, cite. And it's like, oh, the humanity of her. She says, God damn, like the Palestinians, she might have said leadership or something like that, for what they make us do to their children, right? Yeah. Really bloodthirsty and disgusting quote. But even that at this point, given how they responded to him saying, hey, I don't want to see children being bombed. To respond to somebody saying, hey, I don't think that children should be bombed. The crowd enthusiastically cheering, no ceasefire, no ceasefire, no ceasefire. Don't stop the bombing. Don't stop the bombs dropping on the heads of children. Don't stop bombing hospitals. Don't stop bombing bakeries. One of the most despicable, like there are a lot of things in American politics that are abhorrent are sort of left unsaid. You know what I mean? They're implied. Uh-huh. They're danced around. This is a crowd enthusiastically cheering for mass extermination of Palestinian people. And even Van Jones, his milquetoast, weak defense of the humanity of the Palestinians is shouted down. And that's the kind of shit that we're seeing all across the United States of America. I shouldn't say all across the United States of America, as we're going to go to in just a second, some examples of other things. But that's a mindset that exists, particularly in the rooms of the rich and powerful in this country. That is truly, truly disgusting.
Yeah, I'm reading Avi Schlaim's, I don't say this often, magisterial history of Israel's, I guess you'd call it foreign policy, although sometimes that foreign territory becomes your own territory. But it talks about Golda Meir specifically as extremely afraid of never really, unlike certain leaders, like have like some experience with like local Palestinian or other Arab populations. Golda Meir, none of that, just terror and kill them. Yeah, horrible. That's the thing is, I didn't see any overall size total for this.
It was
But, you know, and that's with one, it being unlike the Palestine protests announced. announced everywhere and having literally the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, there. Yes, like, I mean, it's a little bit different. And that no ceasefire thing. The phrase bane for blood, that's what that is. It's like stomach turning to hear a crowd. And what's wild is not even understanding that, oh, actually what we're doing, I mean, maybe not understand, but I see people replying like, why is it different when Israel supporters do it? It's because the Palestine protests are for a ceasefire and you are saying no ceasefire. Like what's hard.
The conflation is unbelievable. And we should be extremely, the thing is like, I know we probably both share the same mindset about this. Is like, if you spend a lot of time apologizing, it does like, it just undermines your point. Right.
Yeah.
But no, like the Palestine rallies are about ceasefire, peace and human dignity. Pro-Israel rallies are in support of mass bombing of 3 million people. Yeah. plus some for a lot of those people, by the way, because they're also including people in the West Bank, as well as Palestinian Israeli citizens as well. But yeah. Matt, we got two bads in the segment. We just did one, and we have one good. Should we keep the bad rolling, or should we do a good in between?
Yeah, let's get the bad rolling. We can leave on a
high note. Get the bad rolling. I don't know how much you've been following this, Matt, but I wanted to, because, you know, you'll hear people whining still to this day, which is unbelievable, as Israel is committing some of the most horrific crimes caught on camera in this mass media age. You know, still hear people whining and crying and certainly cheering on the genocide, but just furious that not only is there any kind of vocal support for people saying, hey, let's not bomb children. People are furious that there's just people out there who are saying, hey, stop doing this shit. And it's wild to me because the people who are advocating for the genocide, for the mass extermination, you know, they've won. They live in a world right now where the United States has the ability to sort of shut down the international communities to stop the bombing of the Palestinians. They live in a country that has outlawed BDS in state after state across the country. They live in a country where the United States government, from the president down to the Senate to the Congress people, are all in full support of the mass slaughter of Palestinian people. At a certain point, you know, it might be worth sort of chalking up your wins, but we know that that's not how it works. And they want pure humiliation, devastation for the Palestinian people, and also punishment for people who have been out here being outspoken against, again, mass extermination and slaughter of human beings. Unfortunately, Matt, your governor in New York has been joining in these charges and have seen this, but they have put out this new program of social media monitoring with the express purpose of defeating anti-Semitism and hate speech. And what they mean by hate speech is, hey, don't bomb children. But let's just play her for a second talking about what.
And just to be clear, anti-Semitism means criticizing Israel.
Yes. Yeah.
Also, we're very focused on the data we're collecting from surveillance efforts. What's being said on social media platforms. Mm. And we have launched an effort to be able to counter some of the negativity and reach out to people when we see hate speech being spoken about on online platforms. Our media analysis, our social media analysis unit, has ramped up its monitoring of sites to catch incitement to violence, direct threats to others. And all this is in response to our desire, our strong commitment to ensure that not only do New Yorkers
to keep getting safe, donor
but
money.
They also feel safe.
So that's the governor of New York basically outlining, you know, a program to which should be worrying enough without any context, right? Yeah. Of, you know, monitoring people. That's the kind of thing if you saw, not to be this guy, but if you saw, you know, an example of this in Iran or North Korea or China or anywhere like that, I think most people would be able to say, hey, that's a little bit worrying to hear the government saying they're going to be.
Yeah. I mean, look, like the Canary Mission has been doing sort of doxing shit and that sort of stuff for a long time and is ramping up now. And now with these investigations, you're seeing Student Justice for Peace or Student Justice for Palestine and Jewish Voices for Peace getting banned from Edward Said's university, right? Yeah, and Obama not saying shit, as far as I'm concerned, about his alma mater. This is something where, you know, I was thinking about, because on the one hand, I think it's a sign of weakness, and I think this issue's at a mass now where they can't, you know, could put this toothpaste back in the tube. On the other hand, if you are, particularly if you have citizenship up in the air, or your employment mm-hmm. is tenuous on it, you do have to be careful about this stuff. And I think do it as part of one of these groups, Students Justice for Palestine or Jewish Voices for Peace or whatever. But if you're like me, I don't have to fucking worry about it. ADL could retweet me, and actually it'd probably be good for my job. Right. but
no, for real,
everybody out there, like, there's safety in numbers. To the extent that you want to do this, like, get, be a part of DSA, be a part of a larger group, and then save some of maybe the tweets that might get you fired. And, you know, move that energy towards that.
Well, frankly, it's an example of why fighting for, you know, things like, sorry, freedom of speech are important fights. As you know, if you, particularly if you're talking to our friends and comrades from Europe, I think a lot of people are unfortunately experiencing what it's like. And look, this is not to sit here and be rah-rah about America. You know, we all fucking know what this country is. But, you know, I've been hearing reports of you know, people, and well, one, like, the most of these protests have been banned outright. People are still marching, which is incredible and brave and correct. But the government's saying, hey, no, you can't come out here and say this. I've even heard reports from people, friends of mine, who've been saying that speaking in Arabic is banned outright. You know, so these are values, and these are things that people should have been paying a lot more attention to and been a little bit more fervent and upstanding. And anyone who's been advocating for Palestine for a long time knows that that's an area where the United States government, where governments all around the world very quickly start stomping on the principles of free speech. But right now it is a fever pitch of attempts from both private and public institutions to try to censor people, to try to punish people for saying, again, let's not bomb children. Some of the most dystopian conversations that you can have. And what we're seeing in New York is incredibly frightening. Hochul said, it's painful to me as a governor of this great state that has been known for its diversity and how we celebrate different cultures, different religions, different viewpoints. It's painful to see the cruelty with which New Yorkers are treating each other. Which, again, she's talking about people saying, don't bomb children, don't bomb children. Because one thing you should be proud of as a New Yorker is seeing all of these rallies from people of all different faiths, including Jewish people, marching in solidarity, saying we oppose this extermination campaign against the Palestinian people. That should be something that gives you pride as a New Yorker. You have to be really fucked in the head to come out there and make this kind of statement.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's be explicit about why. It's not just because they like killing people. It's because it's killing people for a project. And because all the politicians in this country, majority of them, with some few exceptions that, like, they want to call for a ceasefire, but are Zionists and think Zionism is a project that should be continued. And what the problem with that is, it's an exclusionary product, and it has to pursue ethnic cleansing and perhaps even genocide of the population that it doesn't want. And it's doing that. And they're opposing, like, you are opposing American foreign policy when you say stop bombing hospitals and stop bombing journalists and stop bombing kids.
And there's an effort right now from Israel in particular to lobby the governors of states across the country. Your governor went to Israel, if I recall correctly.
Yep.
My governor, Greg Abbott, in the middle of a huge political fight, a lot of things happening in the state of Texas, got on a plane and flew to Israel. Newsom, the governor of Oklahoma, many, many more, because Israel, when it's trying to silence critics right now, is taking a very multifaceted approach. One, directly lobbying Biden, but also trying to get these governors to do things like what we're seeing right here about, monitoring people's social media posts, which is incredibly frightening.
Attack our freedom, yeah.
It's unbelievable. In the first place, to ever think that you have to sign a loyalty pledge to a foreign nation is unbelievable. We've even let this get this far in the first place. But those are the bads. You want to talk about the goods, Matt?
Let's do it.
I was very honored this Sunday to join over 10,000 people in my hometown here in Austin, Texas, in a march of support for Palestinian human rights and dignity. It was something else. I'll just play this video to give you all a sense of it, and then I want to share some thoughts because this is the kind of thing that really matters, is showing up wherever you are at to oppose the extermination, but also to let your friends and neighbors and citizens know that you're standing with them. Because one thing that I really appreciated about this rally was just getting such a visual reminder of what Texas is, who Texans are. But anyways, let's just play a couple seconds of this here. Yeah. And the official numbers are upwards of 10,000 people. We marched from the Capitol down to San Jacinto. And it was an incredibly powerful march. And that's just catching the march.
Yeah, goosebumps.
The speakers there was incredible. The people who spoke before the march was something else. And, you know, this kind of thing, as somebody who's been to a lot of marches and protests in my life, these ones really fucking matter. These ones really fucking matter because while we have governments that are unreflective of the people, this is when it really matters to actually have people out in the street saying, no, as a people, as a state, as a community, as a town, we reject this. It's important to make that message extremely clear to the politicians out there. And it's also extremely important to make that message clear to our Palestinian brothers, sisters, neighbors, citizens, and friends that they are, you know, they're part of this community too, and we have their back. And I'll tell you one thing, not to gripe too much, Matt, but a bunch of the kind of right-wing brigade here in the state of Texas were tweeting out some of the most disgusting things and attacks against this march. What was really funny about it, though, Matt, I will just say this, is that, again, we've been talking about postmodern conservatism. They can't even keep a line straight, right? So some of them were basically saying, because of the skin tone of a lot of people in the march, oh, these aren't Texans. Right. Disgusting, jingoistic, also stupid, knowing the racial demographics.
Well, I was just going to ask that. So you mentioned like a very diverse a turnout, more disproportionately diverse. Do you think they're like, or representationally diverse?
I think it was a little underrepresented in terms of white people there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also don't want to discredit to overstate that. I'm just saying, yeah,
right.
But so the other thing was, okay, so one is they're not Texans because they're not white, right? And then the other side of the right wingers is like college white student, you know, college white kid, right? And they can't even keep it straight. So is it a bunch of fucking UT white UT students, which is also not very reflective of UT student, University of Texas student body either, marching together? Pretty impressive, by the way. You can get 10,000 UT students to march.
Body.
Yeah.
That contradictoriness is so funny. Like, I got accused by, I don't know if people know him, Destiny, who is a blue-haired Twitch streamer. I got called by a fan of his as overusing the term fascism like a blue-haired college student. And, you know, interesting.
But I just want to say this, is that it was an incredibly important thing. And this isn't the first march. This was just such a big one. One of the largest pro-Palestine marches I've ever been in my life, by the way. Not just Texas, in D.C. or in New York. It was incredibly powerful to be there with a bunch of people, you know, the community and the spirit there. But it's also something that we should be able to uphold. Like, that is like the future. That is the Texas that I love to be a part of. That is who we are as a people. And all these fucking fascist motherfuckers, particularly these goddamn Republican freaks who move here from wherever the hell they do, and then they try to impose their bullshit on us. Yeah. Everyone in that rally is way more of a fucking Texan than all these Republican commentators from California or Pennsylvania or whoever the fuck who are saying things like, oh, that's not Texas, because they don't fit into their kind of bullshit vision of what Texans are. I'm sorry. That rally was so extremely Texan. I saw more, for example, you know, not to be superficial about it, I saw more Stetsons than I typically do walking around Austin today. It was led by a couple people on horseback, right? It's just like, fuck you. This is us. Deal with it, motherfuckers.
It looks like, and I'm curious if the DSA was there. The mentioned by the Texas Tribune is Palestinian Youth Movement and PS, Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Yes, that was their big time for sure.
That's I mean, and we'll notice, we'll mention this. Candace Owens is going through her own journey with regards to anti-Semitism and Israel. We'll talk about that in the post game. But the existence of like Jewish Voices for Peace and the prominence, and basically that is a growing movement, is frankly, it's such a massively important tactically. For this struggle, and you know, God bless all those people getting arrested in different places, and also, Palestinian youth movement. Like, I mean, this shit incredible. Is as impressive as anything. Like, you know, Occupy was cool. This to see people coming across at such an important moment like this to come out in support of Palestine. You see Palestinian flags, a greater sense of like what liberation might look like, as opposed to just like, oh, it's, you know, a touchy situation. You know, everybody who's out doing that stuff, you know, great job.
100%. So keep fucking doing it, y'all. I mean, you know, we could have done an update, and this isn't because we're trying to ignore it. The tragedies are ongoing. And Israel's been putting out, dropping more bombs, putting out more insane propaganda. But wanted to take a second here to remind people that, like, the reactions that we're getting from the right, the reactions that we're getting from the government, is because we're making a difference right now. And it's really, really important to, one, understand the urgency, and not to say, I'm not saying like slow down, I'm saying speed up. Because what's happening is making a difference, and continuing fighting is absolutely
critical. Yeah, and just one note, more on note on that. Like, the problem that I'm hearing now, like, Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against Housing Demolitions had an update and talked about the concern is, and what's being telegraphed by the powers is basically removals. Different groups are going to take a certain amount of refugees. You see, like, Ben Shapiro comes saying, absolutely no refugees. But that's setting up a sort of debate. So it's like, okay, well, I guess we have to take some Palestinians in the process of underwriting the ethnic cleansing, which is like, you read any of these books by any of these authors on Israel and the treatment of the West Bank and in Gaza, and they've been looking to roll this stuff up forever. And mm-hmm. this is just a pretext. The pretext is such an important word for this sort of thing. And if you call your representatives, or Jordan Olgut has the ceasefire website, but, you know, mention, like, not only ceasefire, but no ethnic cleansing or removals. Like, we need to be rebuilding Gaza and showing a commitment to actually creating a nation for all those people we're putting through this shit.
100%. Yeah, because I think you're 100% right that, like, what the right and the pro-Israel folks out there would like the framing to be is like, oh, why don't we have a conversation about how many Palestinians the United States and the United Kingdom takes? And what we should be saying very clearly.
And then liberals are going to pat themselves on the back.
Yeah, totally. That's a good point. Absolutely. Is our conversation with Jason ready?
We're ready to go.
All right, folks. We're going to be talking a little Candace Owens in the post game, who's been going through it a little bit. I'm really looking forward to that. You get to access that patreon.com/leftreckoning. If you like this program and the stuff that Matt and I are able to cover here, please do consider supporting. It's $5 a month. It really helps us grow. If that's too high and you need some help, feel free to reach out to us and send us an email. We can always try to find something that works for you. We want you to be in the community, have access to all of the bonus stuff that we're doing out there. Let's jump over to Jason Miles, our good friend from This Is Revolution, to talk about his new piece on Ibram X. Kendi out in Damage Magazine. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined as always by Matt Leck. How you doing, brother?
Doing good, Dave. Good to be with you.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, to be joined not just by my good friend Matt Leck, but my other good friend Jason Miles. You know and love Jason Miles from excellent podcasts like This Is Revolution, his writings in Sublation Magazine and other places. But what we're going to be talking about today is his new piece in Damage Magazine, which, again, plug for Damage always. People should definitely be reading Damage if you aren't already. They have a really exciting new print issue out now. But the piece we're talking about today is written by our good friend Jason, called The Man Who Sold the World, and it's about Ibram X. Kendi. Jason, thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I keep forgetting the camera's here. Thanks for having me on. I literally miss you guys. Oh, no.
We're still here. Okay. I just put the article up for people to see the title and stuff.
Cool.
Yeah. No, man, I know it has been a little while. I'm happy to be having you back on the program, man. I mean, you know, it's fun, though. Like, we do have, like, a little bit of a crew here between This Revolution and Ben Show It. Give them an argument that, like, we're always sort of in the conversation. I feel like I'm talking to y'all all the time, even when I'm not talking to y'all all the time. That's, I guess, what I'm saying.
We're actual friends in real life. We've actually bred and hung out and, you know. Yeah. Done all the things. We do live stuff together. It's a friendship that I actually really value and cherish. I'm being totally serious.
No, same here, man. Truly. Well, let's, I mean, I'm sure people would actually like us to talk for a little bit longer about how much we all love each other and really, really think we are. But let's talk about somebody who we might have some disagreements here. This piece in Damage is really phenomenal. And I actually really want to get more into like the kind of like theoretical, philosophical pieces that you're making in this piece. But maybe just to set us all up, sure. Could you remind people who Ibram X. Kendi is, in case they might not be as familiar with his work?
Sure. Ibram X. Kendi is a Black intellectual that wrote a book that won a National Book Award, actually, before he wrote a text that kind of is what he's known for now, which is How to Be an Anti-Racist. He wrote Stamped from the Beginning, which is kind of a genic text. That you, winning a book award doesn't necessarily mean that you are everybody's favorite writer. How to Be an Anti-Racist really puts Kendi on the map because it really simplifies, in my opinion, you know, kind of Black people's at large predicament in America, which is it's always about racism and all these policies that we've faced, from, you know, redlining to the war on drugs to just any, literally, I believe he says any policy. It's racist in nature. So that's from the war on drugs to, you know, curb height on a sidewalk. I guess it's all racist, right? And I did read the book. I actually read the book. And there's one thing Kendi talks about that I think for a while was giving him some play in some more far left circles, not just liberal circles, is that he talks about anti-capitalism. Mm-hmm. And he says, first of all, you have to be an anti-capitalist, but you can't be an anti-capitalist unless you're an anti-racist, because capitalism and racism are these conjoined twins. And you can't hate the system without hating racism. So first we must tackle racism. So he kind of waves a hand at capitalism, but everything else is about your own personal journey. And he starts the book by talking about his own personal journey, which is kind of a common journey for a lot of people of his age. He's maybe a couple years younger than me. So we come from an era where a lot of tough on crime rhetoric was quite popular. If you think about Chris Rock, and I'm sure people in your audience know who Chris Rock is. Chris Rock really comes on the comedic scene as a stand-up for people outside of his kind of Black-only audience, when he does a special where he talks about the difference between different types of Black people. It's so popular, it's the second episode of The Office. They joke about this, right? You know, the N-words and Black people. And that's literally underclass ideology, right? But Chris Rock isn't necessarily saying poor people. And this is what Kendi was talking about when he starts his book, that he's kind of using a lot of these tropes, but that's his internalized racism. And it's almost like a spiritual journey that he goes on in the book. And to a certain degree, you can say D'Angelo Kelly's White Fragility is
Robin D'Angelo.
Yeah, what did I say?
D'Angelo Kelly.
I mixed her up with Robin D.G. Kelly. a different Robin, and that's a whole different critique, but also mildly problematic in my book. But, you know, Kendi goes on this spiritual journey to be a decent person, and the book literally says, you don't want to be a racist? Don't be a racist. Don't accept racist policies. That goes for homophobia. That goes for sexism. All isms. Just don't be it. And any policy that you see that might be racist in nature, then just be against it.
Well, I was just going to say that, like, you know, I just want to read a little bit from your piece. Says about Kendi. Kendi's philosophy was so simple, in fact, that it could be easily ported to other contexts. Homophobia, don't be homophobic. Sexism, don't be sexist. Kendi waves at things like capitalism, but his solutions always involve challenging the inner demon within that might cause you to promote or believe in racist policies. Once we get rid of racism, then all the other big bads like patriarchy and capitalism will fade away. And I sort of wanted to like tease that out a little bit with you here. Because, you know, whenever we do certain things with the all over at TIR, or like if we'll have an Adolf Reed or something like that on the program, I think a lot of people always misunderstand the kind of maybe more materialist socialist critique of some of these kind of, I don't know, pop anti-racist movements right now, where socialists are saying, hey, racism doesn't matter. We don't think racism exists. Or if it does exist in any way, we think that, you know, class should sort of supersede racism. But I think that more accurately, the way to describe the critique is rather that, you know, rather than racism driving capitalism, capitalism produces racism. You know, so sort of understanding materially where these things come from, then we're much better equipped to actually fight these things in the real world for people. And that note that you make there about, you know, fighting this inner demon too, really gets, I think, to the heart of a lot of the kind of pop anti-racist stuff that we get today, which is sort of like, you know, do the work on the individual level, right? Find the little racist inside of you and like crush them. You know, and like, look, I'm no therapist. You know, I can't tell people how to deal with like people on an individual level, but on a political level, I mean, that's not a, you know, a real call for much. In fact, it's actually like a call in an ironic way for a lot of these texts that are trying to be political texts. It's actually like a call to take things out of the political realm and to put them onto the interpersonal realm. But so, I mean, I sort of front loaded the question, but I'm curious, you know, how you disentangle this for people who might get confused when we say these kind of critiques about somebody like
it happened to me literally in my house, man. You know, I had someone come interview me here, very, very nice woman. And, you know, she said something about being a class reductionist. And I was like, I don't get it. We got into it a little bit. I think that's one of the more popular interviews on her channel. She interviewed me and a bunch of other people. And, I'm sure people were not happy with what I had to say, because there's a difference between, like, you know, racism and discrimination, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of just don't care about certain subtle racisms that become kind of a major cause. And actually, Kendi talks about in the book, talking about microaggressions, you know, he says, well, I don't believe in microaggressions. All these things are, you know, aggressions in their attacks. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, Kendi, do you really give a damn if some random white lady at a Bed Bath and Beyond tells you you got nappy hair or you speak so well? I mean, does that really F up your day that much when you're getting $45 million in grants? You know, sometimes this anti-racism talk can get us trying to get this trickle-down effect from these well-to-do black people, kind of you know, Oprah can't buy a purse, so now it's all of our burden. And Oprah's, you know, mild racisms that she may face are not going to be mine. You know, I said this on another show and it's extremely true. Right now my tags are expired and I'm doing a live thing, in the Bay Area, and I have to drive up there. You know, expired tags in Mexico is pretty chill. But once I cross that imaginary line, it's not chill. I don't have family that could bail me out of jail. Obviously I don't have money to get the tags fixed right at this minute. I got insurance, so hopefully they don't impound my car. But, you know, the discrimination, the racism I may face if one of these legit racist cops wants to just screw my day over, you know, it's way different. And no one's gonna do anything for me unless I get killed running, right? And that's probably not going to happen. It's just going to be uncomfortable. Maybe something happens to my, I need to stop talking about this. but ultimately, you know, these are very different. And, and Oprah's wins and Obama's wins don't trickle down. Trickle down didn't work for America with Reagan. For some reason, racially, we're supposed to believe that trickle down works for us. Now, I always want to say, just because I understand that there's class issues within Black America doesn't mean that I haven't experienced real discrimination. You know what I mean? With some cats that were in the Klan, we weren't buddies. You know what I mean? It sucked. So this idea that if you're a socialist, you're automatically assuming that racism isn't real, It's an oversimplified conversation about something that's more complicated. And we're talking about the economic quality of life of 40 million Black Americans. And Ibrahim X. Kendi, and a lot of people like him, sadly, I didn't want him to be the major focal point, because I don't want people to go, once he's gone, then that problem is gone. Mm-hmm. Because you'll always have someone else that's going to be the racial ventriloquist for these 40 million Black people. I'm sorry, I'll shut up.
No,
I've always thought of that, like that question of the microaggression thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, I think if you ask any like a person that deals with any kind of discrimination, like, okay, on the one hand, we can make sure that the disinvestment in your community is we take care of that. On the other hand, we can make sure that you don't face like suspicion in shopping centers. Like, I think most people, like, well, they see both those are bad, don't weigh them precisely equally. I think, like, most people say, like, I'll take being able to pay my rent and healthcare and those essentials, and then, like, I'm actually even more empowered to fight the other stuff in society after that. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Jason.
That's actually a really good point. That's part of the conversation that we're not having, right? When we talk about people's material conditions. And what's really effing up your day? You know, if you look at the LA riots, there were tipping points, but people were extremely angry because their conditions hadn't gotten better in 30 years. Factories had left the number two manufacturing city in the nation for car manufacturing. You know, you have racial fights, because now you have a large segment of the Latin population that is now citizens and taking some of the jobs that Black people had at one point in time. Black people now can get into the unionized job sector, and you know, again, that's gone. So when all you have at that time for a lot of people in South Central Los Angeles was the drug trade, was the industry at large, or maybe you can get like a little mom and pop store, you know, cats are going to be angry. But all we got to see was Rodney King. And if you look really close, Latasha Harlan's. And these are tragedies, especially Latasha Harlan's case. This girl's only 13 years old. Do you know what I mean? But LA's problems were much deeper, and they started way further back than simply a racist police force. The racist police force was part of it. Actually, a violent police force was part of it. There were Black people killing, you know, other Black people on that police force since the early 80s. But again, what is police's role? Is kind of to protect capital and property. It's not going to be to protect these citizens that are a surplus population. And nothing that these ventriloquists say or write really talks to that vulnerability you feel when you're part of a surplus population. And I think why it hits me in a certain emotional way is because I feel that I've grown up in Richmond, California as part of the surplus population. And I'm tired of us listening to these people.
I mean, I think that's, you know, it really hits, I think, to the reason that a lot of these things are extremely popular and well-funded as ideas, right? One, because I think of the lack of, like, political program that could, like, positive political program that can be built out of them, right? So it's not really a threat to capital or capitalism. But also, it's something that...
Go ahead, finish your point, sorry.
No, I was just saying, it's like, you know, focusing on interpersonal interactions, right? Which can, you know, just 100% just be like inappropriate and offensive and all that kind of stuff. You know, sort of centering and focusing on that was like, well, the idea is that maybe you can get like a broader support across the audience between people who are maybe less well-off and more well-off. And particularly the people who have the influence over who's getting certain kinds of jobs, what things are getting published. That becomes something that's a lot more important than getting into some of those structural root causes that you're talking about in like your life experience in California or all across the country.
Yeah, man. I mean, I wanted to write about where I'm from because I think it really centers my disdain and why more people should be paying attention, why these people are kind of charlatans. And I'm from a city called Richmond, California, which is one of the most diverse cities in the country. When I did that research, I was like, oh, no shit. But it's also one of the poorest.
Mm-hmm.
And we deal with massive amounts of pollution in the city. Every woman in my life that has passed away from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's just been diagnosed. So it's a reality of where I live. I live in one of those places, right? Where Chevron mm-hmm. reigns supreme. And you can't do anything about it. But we have a Latin mayor at the moment, a black female chief of police, a mixed race city council filled with men and women and people of different genders. So we've got the diversity quota covered, right? But it's an extremely poor city. Mm-hmm. So how is racism or being an anti-racist going to help the black woman working at, you know, McDonald's when her boss is black, the owner is black, her city council person is black, the people robbing her are black? You know, it's like, I don't know if representation at this point is going to get her out of this impoverished situation. She might have to, you know, get with her other black and Latin and Southeast Asian co-workers to try to unionize, which is, you know, a no-no mm-hmm. word. And they don't really talk about unions in this stuff, because when you talk mm-hmm. about labor struggles, which is something you guys talk about a lot on the show, and everybody should, you know, kind of appreciate you guys for that, because not everybody wants to talk about labor struggles in a certain kind of light. You're getting people across so many different you know, ethnic backgrounds, even sometimes class backgrounds, when we're talking about mm-hmm. broad labor struggles, like what we saw in West Virginia with that teacher's strike. It's foolish to assume that all those people were going to vote for Joe Biden. And there was definitely some mm-hmm. Trump supporters. There was definitely some racists in there. You know, even when you talk to someone like Chris Smalls, when he's trying to organize his warehouse in New York, you know, he had people in there that definitely, you know, he probably wouldn't have, quote unquote, had a beer with. But trying to get to this bigger political project, this idea of socialized democracy opposed to racialized democracy, I think is kind of where we want to go on our show, and probably where you guys want to go on your show, and where we want mm-hmm. the country to go. Hopefully we're seeing it go in that direction again with a lot of these labor struggles, and even what we're seeing with a lot of these protests with what's going on in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's my hopeful.
Yeah, and it's just funny how, like, I mean, we've obviously hit this over like so many times, but they talk about, look at these, there's something white about the UAW, and then you actually look at the picket line, it's like, oh, I guess it's not just all a bunch of Sean Fain clones walking off the up the picket line.
It'd be a very funny image, though, I gotta say.
Like minions.
Weird people. Yes. Pandemic for you, huh?
I also wanted to flag Keith Orahel, who we talked about rural America with. I do want to flag one tweet he had about Kendi when it came out that the was it MIT or wherever he was.
Boston University.
Yeah, like that. They lost a lot of money there. Keith said, "Everyone is dragging Kendi, but destroying a bunch of corporate wealth is probably the most radical thing he's done."
You got like $10 million off the bat from Jack Dorsey.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Solve racism. And
it's like no one stopped to go, really? But when we think about all the money that was dumped, we had a left reckoning. There was mm-hmm. a racial reckoning in 2020. And with all those protests, all the corporate money that got dumped into so many foundations, how many foundations were started? How many of those foundations would stop making George Floyd's? Like their whole goal was that we don't want any more George Floyd. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many people got art grants to make movies about George Floyd? How many people got grants to write books about a George Floyd type person? Or just black stuff in general? Just stuff that wasn't going to benefit his life, which I find disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But again, we don't talk about this because the evil that's baked into America, right, is the evil of racism. If we can only see slavery through racialized lens, we can't really understand the economics of slavery.
Yeah, and you get to that in your piece about, it's about recognition, and as long as like the political class can be like, things like, as long as we are seen recognizing this, that's really all we need to do.
Mm-hmm. Joe Biden's like whole campaign slogan should for 24 should just be like, I see you, I hear you, can't do anything, friend. You know, yeah. It's like, that's like the Democratic Party right now. Yeah.
Well, you know, in writing this piece, I was looking for the Hillary Clinton quote.
She says,
right? And I thought it was in a Bernie debate, and it wasn't. It was in town hall. So I actually read through the transcripts of her and Bernie's debate. And in reading through those transcripts, one thing that I saw was Hillary Clinton, after Bernie gets, I wouldn't say after, but it's around the same time that he gets hit up by BLM when they're like, you don't have a black agenda. The Democratic Party kind of learns the best way to stop a redistributive campaign is to just point out racism and sexism. Hillary Clinton quote to me is a lot of people in a nutshell.
Yeah.
You know, I can regulate all the banks, but I can't stop racism, or it's going to stop racism.
This gets to, you know, not to put you on the spot of, you know, summarizing someone else's work, but, you know, Torrey Reed, someone whose work I respect tremendously, you know, a lot of his work on the New Deal and those social programs is really tremendous. People should read Torrey's work first and foremost. But, you know, really what the way that this has been sort of brought up in like modern progressive discourse, or maybe we should even just be more clear, like Democratic Party sponsored places of discussion, is to sort of look at an example in this country. Look, and I'm a radical, right? I think that there's sometimes a little bit too much FDR worship on our side. But it was probably one of the best damn things we've seen in this country from any kind of political, you know, elected in power political movement ever. And, you know, when it comes to like the New Deal, it's like there are tremendous examples of discrimination against black people. I mean, hell, I've been working on this piece on something that's been going on, the story of the Southern tenant farmers who got really screwed over by the New Deal for a while. They had to fight, and they were able to win back some of those protections and things that were promised. But like, yeah, no, this is very true. It's an incomplete project. And there were parts of it that were racist. There are parts of it that were just like anti-worker and things like that. But at the end of the day, and this is why Torrey's work is so good, is it's sort of like, yeah, well, then the demand should actually be that like we expand those things and give them to everybody. But the kind of think tank DC liberal response is like, see, yeah, that's exactly why like social programs can't work, because racism, right? And it's just like, it's such a defeatist argument, frankly, because we're basically saying that we can't really tackle these things until there is some. And again, when you talk about racism, not as like a socially produced phenomenon, but something that is just like you're born with, right? Or it's like a spiritual force. You drink the wrong water, now you're, you know, whatever. You need to be cleaned or whatever, you know, whatever. Like, I'm also not trying to dismiss like the actual like practice of like teaching your children racist shit, from the overt stuff to just like the kind of, I mean, you know, an example of racism, the way that it's taught is like, you know, your parents don't even have to be racist, but like maybe when you're a kid and a black person walks next to you, they hold your hand a little bit tighter, right? And that's like a subtle message of like it racism and things like that. But to be able to deal with this on like a holistic scale, we need like mass social programs and mass political movements that deal with the underlying cause of racism and racialized thinking in this country, which is to divide working class people. And it's also to brutalize certain communities so that they don't have the ability to stand up and fight for higher wages. They don't have the ability to quit their job if they're being abused, right? These are all baked into the cake of capitalism. And when your response to the shortcomings of the New Deal are just like, yeah, exactly. You know, you can't have social policy. See, instead of saying what to me is so much clearer, is like, yeah, exactly. That's why we need to expand social policy.
Yeah, do all that, but not racistly.
Think about Bill Clinton, and think about some of the things that get rolled out in that first term.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The crime bill is almost incremental, because for some time you're starting to see more tough on crime sentencing in places like California. Right. Mm-hmm. Because crack cocaine does make things violent. I was on the show before. I wrote a piece in Sublation about my thoughts on the 90s and 80s and crack. Mm-hmm. Look it up. We don't need to, you know, rehash that whole conversation. But one thing that happens, and Torrey, speaking of all people, he pointed this out to me to the point where I had to look this shit up. Like, Negro, you telling me the truth? He said, keep in mind, around the same time, that the crime bill is coming down. Hate crime legislation is coming down around the same time. That we're going to add a sentencing requirement to hate crimes. Now, there had been hate crime legislation since the late 60s, when you probably really had racialized violence in the late 60s. Not to what you got in the lynching era of the 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah, which we never legislated about.
Right? At all, right? So 68 is kind of a, I see you, I hear you.
Yeah. Right.
93, you get, I don't just see you and hear you, I'm acting. You also get welfare reform that he signs in front of a whole bunch of black people and was cheered on by the black bourgeois community at the time. Because there's a certain stratum of kind of the kindy class, especially in this era, that was that Chris Rock joke. There's N-words and there's black people. And nobody wanted to be associated with the N-word. So the welfare queen is a real trope. Now you can say that's your internalized racism. All right, whatever you want to say, but we have to be honest about what was going on at that time and the people that said this is a good idea. So by the time the crime bill comes down, there were people in the black activist class that were like, this is good because we need to lock these people up for long periods of time. Build more jails if you have to, because the police response time isn't fast enough. My city's violent. So lock them up. And take away the welfare money because we're tired of these welfare queens. So the 90s is a very conservative time that we don't really think about. There's a lot of financial deregulation that's going on around this time as well. That's also hurting these poor black and brown communities. And we don't really talk about it when you're looking through the lens of everything's racist. Right? Because Bill Clinton played that game probably better than anyone.
First black president.
First black. and who coined that phrase?
Tony Morrison. Morrison. Yeah.
Tony Morrison. So when you, again, to think, oh, wow, hate crime legislation, that extra sentence comes down in a moment where black people ain't scared about the Klan. These murders that are happening in South Central, it's not a bunch of night riders from the Klan coming up from, you know, Louisiana, going to get all the Negros in L.A. That's not how this is working out. But I'm waving a hand that I see you. I hear you. Look, I'm actually acting. You guys got tired of the welfare queen. Look, I handled it. But the real structural problems never really got solved. We never got jobs programs, really. Right. There was just more restrictions on how you were going to get your benefits, which hurt, you know, tens of millions of people, including children, most.
And I think this actually gets us. Tell me if we're going too broad here. But like, you know, I think one thing that is really notable about like the modern kind of political like discourse in this country, particularly from like the liberal side, is sort of flattening entire groups of people into a very clear and simple political identity. And I think one, that's wrong. It's just wrong to view people as like a monolith. Two, it's politically disastrous, as we are starting to see some of these things that we've been seeing where, like, you know, Donald Trump has been picking up support with black voters, right? Donald Trump has been picking up support with some Latino voters. Now, you can still look very clearly, it's skewed very much more towards the Democratic Party, but this idea that the Democrats were just going to sort of have this as their voting block forever is like, one, it's like it's a bad political strategy, particularly if you're not delivering for people, right? But two, I mean, I sort of want to get into this a little bit with you, Jason, if you don't mind, because like, I do think even a lot of people consider themselves on the left or socialists, they talk in this overarching way about, like, you know, black people. And I think that that's not helpful when you see that, you know, the black community, like that demographic group in this country, incredibly diverse when it comes to income and class interests and material interests. And you can see that play out, I think, very clearly in politics, right? where there are certain people who have a lot of influence over politics, over others. And is it surprising that those are the people who tend to have a lot more money, a lot more access to education, more security? That might actually not be very representative of like the entire group of people as a whole, right?
But I mean, you know, keeping that conversation up about the group as a whole is actually a very profitable conversation. It's a very, you know, mainstream media friendly conversation, mm-hmm. and on both sides of it, right? If you work for Fox News, if you're mm-hmm. MSNBC. So to kind of get into the weeds about like, you know, Black political thought was diverse during Reconstruction, when Black people were becoming congressmen and mayors and senators mm-hmm. and governors. You know, no one wants to think that. No one wants to have that conversation. No one wants to read those texts. It's just easier to think that there is a unified Black thought. But Teray and Cedric talk about this. You know, I think there's more Black people in the U.S. than there is people in Canada. I mean, we never talk about the Canadian vote. I was talking with a Canadian friend earlier today, and we were talking about just the politics, just the politics of Native, or whatever they're called, the Montreal, the people that speak Quebecois.
Yeah, Quebecois. Quebec,
yeah.
And kind of the politics around. And that's just one province in a massively large country that doesn't have the biggest population, but still. Mm-hmm. The politics, and that was like, I was like, dude, can you send me some literature on this? Like, this is this is deep. This goes back a long ways, and you're gonna have diverse political opinions throughout the Black mm-hmm. spectrum. But keep in mind, you know, back to the pop culture element to make it a little bit easier for people to digest. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is a show that Quincy Jones wants to make because he wants to show Black conservatives
because
mm-hmm. he's a Black conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And he literally wanted to show that life because he felt it wasn't being depicted on television.
Yeah, and so, fair enough, frankly, I will say, not to be too much of a bleeding heart liberal, fair enough, right? It's just like, you know, it's like if it's a thing that exists, it's like, I don't know, artistically, show us the world, right? I don't know.
He doesn't think he's an outlier, right? Because mm-hmm. he's not an outlier.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the only rich dude on his block.
Mm-hmm.
So, It's foolish to think that there's this unified vision. But what happens when you get that idea of a unified vision, then you always get, like we said earlier, that racial ventriloquist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Kendi positioned himself really, really well to be corporate America's racial ventriloquist. So even outside of the political realm, what mm-hmm. his message was perfect for corporate America, which is starting to incorporate more Black women.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're experiencing some racism at work because, you know, Sarah says, why is your hair like that? You know, damn you, Sarah, in accounting. Kendi will come in and give a speech to the office and have you guys take an anti-racism course. And we've fixed your large Black female corporate population that's getting frustrated with the way things are. Now they're not going to ask for a raise. They're not going to ask for time off if they decide to have children. Fuck them asking for those things. Let's just address, you know, Sarah in accounting and the silly shit she says after she watches, you know, like an Eddie Murphy movie.
Well, you know, and just, sorry, Matt, you go.
I was curious, like the whole PR turn with Kendi, I think that was apparent. You know, we weren't interested in having him on post the D'Angelo, Robin D'Angelo and the how to be an anti-racist sort of basically self-help turn. I was curious. I remembered we had him on Two Dope Boys in a Podcast, actually, which with Michael Brooks and Phil McKenzie. And for folks who don't remember that was basically the Michael Brooks show deal where we were expecting a Hillary Clinton America, and the whole idea was to use these sort of corporate initiatives as like a Trojan horse for more radicalism. So Kendi was kind of like stamped from the beginning book. I'm curious, do you think it was clear from stamped from the beginning that this was a turn he was going to make? Because I do remember that book, I read it. It was like basically countering racism denial in America. I'm curious what if you remember that time period before the turn, Jason.
It's like 2016, I think.
Yeah, 2016, 2017.
We're actually gonna be talking about that moment on our show tonight. I was like this close to seeing if you Dirty Sons of Bitches were available. No, mm-hmm. I think you have to be a bit of a true believer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe Ibrahim X. Kendi is a comic book villain that's sitting mm-hmm. here like this. You can't get that second book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, unless there's a true believer in you for the first book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you really read that second book, you go, yeah, I think you really believe this and feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, when he was starting it off before he got all the foundation money, you would see him with kind of, you know, hopeful glow in his eyes. Like, I think I'm going to write a children's book.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, this was his cause. This was the thing that he was going to do. This is the thing he's going to talk about that in his mind is going to change the world. And yeah, I don't look at him as a guy that saw a turn, so to speak. Like, for example, there's a politician in LA that really set off a lot of the events that happened in city council named Nuri Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine who I don't know if you guys met him at the LA show, he actually worked on the LA city council for Gil Cedillo. And he sent me this thing, and Nuri Martinez is pivoting to a Republican after the events that happened to her, where it was a hit job. We have to be honest, was a hit job. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what racial coalition politics sounds like when you're talking about gerrymandering. So that conversation is racist as you want it to be. Every ethnic political coalition in the city, when you're gerrymandering a district, is trying to figure out how they're going to keep their power. So every conversation was sounding similar to that. But that being said, I asked our friend, was Nuri kind of always Republican? He's like, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. You know, this isn't really the heel turn that you think it is in a kayfabe kind of way. It's like, this is literally, she got hosed in her mind.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the only pivot that she feels comfortable making. And maybe she feels a little bit more comfortable being a little more conservative on things that she probably had to fake being a little more liberal on. So, And she's relocated too. She's in Arizona.
Oh, well, man, that's a good, if you're going to switch,
right?
You know that's where to go, right?
You know, when the vibe changes, you know, it's like, oh, like, you know, living here in Mexico, like I kind of get some things like why there is conservative element to certain populations.
Well, I wanted to maybe in the last couple of minutes sort of like tie this to something. And it's a funny example to use now, because I think we're all probably pretty mad at him, Mr. Bernard Sanders. But you open
literally, I'm literally talking about that tonight.
I know, we're all like, but like, you know, if everyone can just accept, I just want to talk about this movement and maybe not get too worked up on Bernie right now. Mm-hmm. You open up your piece in Damage by saying, when was Bernie's moment ill-fated? Some would say it wasn't until March 2020. Others say it was compromised from the start. For me, it was the Sanders speech in Seattle on Social Security and Medicare. The speech never got off the ground because just as Sanders started to speak, a small group of Black Lives Matter protesters started shouting and took to the podium. It would be the second time in 2 months that BLM protesters interrupted a Sanders campaign event to speak about police violence, reparations, and the original sin that seems to be baked into the American body politic, racism. I wanted to sort of talk to you about a little bit about, I think around here, we probably know why that was effective in terms of the Democratic Party in general. And again, I tell me if you disagree with me on this at all either, Jason. I don't even think that the stuff that was happening with Bernie was cynical in terms of the activists. Like, I might disagree with them. I think it was like true believers. This is the politics that's been sort of cultivated around it. So again, it wasn't some cynical or sinister plan to derail it, but it was actually the effect of a kind of plan cultivated by others. I wanted to sort of ask you about, like, you know, how you feel about that moment, and more importantly, how you think that this sort of playing out today, because we've all been doing this for a little while. I'm curious, because part of me feels like what we experienced politically between 2018 and 2020, that is still with us to a certain extent, but I think it's sort of weakened a little bit. And I'm curious if you agree with that. And maybe if you have any thoughts as to why. I have some, but I don't want to front load too much.
I mean, I can only talk about it from my personal perspective of it, when it was going on. When I saw it happen, it was like, ooh, that felt like a hit. And there's people in our community that definitely felt like it was a hit job. Mainly because it turned Bernie Sanders into just a regular old white guy.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to activists in my Bay Area community that felt that a choice between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump was a choice between just two 70-year-old white dudes.
Mm.
And I was like, really don't, he's like, and they were always like, I don't care if Bernie went against or marched with King, because, you know, that was a million years ago. And that's how a lot of people look at that stuff. Like, that was a million years ago. People can change. And there's a certain degree of truth that we have to accept with that. Like, mm-hmm. we have to accept that not every abolitionist, to Kendi's point, was an anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
But waiting for Abraham Lincoln to see the humanity in me, we wasn't going to get free.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you have a certain coalition of people that may not think that highly of you, are you getting the thing done that's going to get you where you want to go? And that's kind of a broader conversation that people don't feel comfortable having, because it's so easy to go, hey, we're having this massive protest here in Seattle and it's 1999 and maybe we can change the world. Sure is white out here.
Mm.
Well, go get some black people that I don't know what the fuck to tell you. Like, what are you telling me this because you think I have the key? Like, or do you want to go do it?
Mm.
Or are you just saying that because you want it to be said? So again, it's the Bernie Sanders moment. He was fighting that all through the next campaign as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd probably feel more comfortable having an off-air conversation with you guys. Well, I already acted up and said some stuff on a different interview for a different podcast. I named some names.
No, Bernie is, it's like the comet of calling Bernie a sexist. It arrives like in our solar system every time there's a primary in Iowa that he's participating in. Like just like
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah,
he's exactly. Anti-Semite.
Jeremy Corbyn, yeah, which is, I think...
Look, you throw the racial thing out there and you're too busy defending that. Mm-hmm. And when you watch, if you go back and read the transcripts or even watch those debates, it felt like he was constantly backpedaling the race issue because he had some core issues that he wanted to get across. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of back to the social democratic vision of the United States, this kind of new deal. We need healthcare. We need free college. You know, he was also talking about housing. These were real. These are real problems for real Americans. Like, if you said we're going to relieve you guys of student loan debt, mm-hmm. I'm sure the two guys on the screen can get a bit of a boot released off their neck.
Mm.
You know, imagine how many Americans can financially thrive with that boot lifted off. Yeah. And you start looking at housing from a federal level and not just a state level.
Mm-hmm. 100%. And that, yeah.
You know, that's the kind of presidency that we were looking at. And all that gets thrown out the window because you believe he doesn't have reparations on his agenda. And I didn't have enough words to write, and I had to get rid of that whole part. Mm-hmm. Because you have to talk about Ta-Nehisi Coates in the case for reparations.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of talked about Richard Rothstein's Color of Law.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those two things come out and they become like definitive gospel of racism being baked into this country, and that we can't do anything without fixing racism first.
You know, I think that one thing that was really notable about the Bernie Sanders, I don't want to call it a moment because it makes me sound depressed, right? But, you know, maybe that is what
too
it
honest.
Is.
I don't know.
Yeah, it might be too honest. You know, but like, I think one thing that was really notable, and like, you know, all of us have sort of been around, you know, the left for a while. Some of us maybe longer than others on the screen. You know, one thing that became really clear during the Bernie, particularly in like 2015, 2016, and then it just was exceptional in 2020, was a lot of people who you might sort of consider in the pop culture world or the intellectual pop culture world, I guess is what I'm saying. It's like, oh, that's a radical. That's a radical. That's a radical. That's a radical. Mm-hmm. It became really clear how much, if they were radicals at one point or another, how much they had sort of toned down their radicalism in how they interacted with the Bernie Sanders movement. Because a lot of figures who were considered to be extreme radicals and left-wingers in the 90s and 2000s really struggled to find a place for themselves within the Bernie Sanders movement, not because the door was shut or anything like that, but rather because Bernie Sanders was sort of encouraging the radical left in this country to sort of revive its critique of capitalism, not just as a force, right? Again, like all these people, a lot of people are really good at talking about capitalism at this point, right? Where they're like, oh yeah, capitalism is bad. But when you actually start talking about like policies or politics, you know, the capitalism is like five steps behind. The capitalism critique is like way to the back of any kind of critique. And under Bernie, I think it became really, really, really clear that a lot of those people weren't actually as interested in that kind of systemic change, but rather did like to have the positions that they had, which is sort of, you know, pushing around the edges of the ruling class or the influential class in this country. And trying to find, you know, spaces and influences with it. And Bernie Sanders sort of exploded that and sort of reinvigorated some kind of bottom up thing, which I think threatened a lot of people who get to present themselves as the spokespeople for different groups of folks in this country. And I think that created a lot of animosity. And of course, was very skillfully used, I will admit, skillfully used by people like Clinton and other Democratic officials to sort of attack that this movement.
I mean, Clinton gets an okay from, you know, black intellectuals walking in the door, and it's going to be a reprieve from 12 years of right-wing conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't look at the deregulation and the crime bill and the welfare reform as bad things. Even after he's gone out of office, we miss it because financially, through a lot of that deregulation, with cheap credit, we can buy everything we want.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, how many of your friends moved out of the hood and went to the suburbs in the late 90s through the mid aughts through, you know, no money down, no income verifying loans?
Mm-hmm.
That only can happen when you have that many regulations released in the market, right? Glass-Steagall mm-hmm. is gone kind of by 94, but I think 98 is when it's officially over. And we still haven't really reined in those protections yet.
Mm-hmm.
There's really still no firewalls.
No, it's crazy, honestly. Right? Financial crisis, yeah.
We see this stuff happening. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to cut you. I was just like throwing on my gem hat, my former position on TMBS. I mean, we are literally living through the wreckage of the attempt to try to deal with the financial crisis, which is just pumping the economy up with cheap money. Which, of course, capitalism is an extremely unequal system, so that money flowed one way, you know, to a world where, like, you know, you look at the wreckage of what life is like for working class Americans today, that's baked into the system of capitalism, but the acuity of it, like how serious it is, the inequality that is so visible to people, that's 100% Barack Obama, you know, financial policy after the financial crisis, because instead of taking on a fight with financial capital in this country, we're just like, oh, all right, what we need to do is we need to give them more money. And
we surrendered.
Yeah, completely.
We surrendered.
Completely.
There's a moment in America where people are pissed off, that kind of Occupy moment. But we're still not really talking about socialism to the level that we're talking about during Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the next step after Occupy.
And that's why it's so much more serious. I'm not cutting you off. I'm just saying it's so much more serious, Bernie is. It's just not even close. People still trying to put those two as equal moments. They're not. You can say one might have created some openings for the other, but no, it's completely the fetishization of having people in the street versus having a political movement. People really need to wake themselves up for which one is more important of the two.
You know what? I was with a mutual friend of ours. So I don't know if he's friends with you guys, but he definitely was friends with the late Michael Brooks. Mm-hmm. And he was part of those anti-war protests. And I don't want to say his name on air. He's no longer really on social media and stuff. Mm-hmm. Definitely is still a presence in certain activism circles. But we were hanging out at his house after a concert recently, and we're chilling, and we were talking about that moment because I was very inquisitive about it. And he was like, look, man, we weren't tied in with any labor unions. We didn't have a political movement in 2003. And the state just waited us out.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And that's what you said. You know, this stuff, we never want it to become something that's just cathartic, because 2020 ultimately was just cathartic.
Yeah.
91 was just cathartic. So once the catharsis is over, once you've met with people, are you trying to build something beyond the protest with other community leaders that you're meeting in the streets to really challenge power? Are you lining up with different labor unions in your protest because you really want to do some level of general strike, shut shit down when you're calling for a ceasefire? Or do you want to, you know, wave your fist at power? Because 2003 showed us that the largest protest the world has ever known globally, nothing changed. Power looked at their watch. Y'all finished? Good. And no one talks about Afghanistan anymore. No one talks about how horrible Bush Jr. was.
Mm-hmm.
These things are gone. Now we're laser focused on Donald Trump and his odd term in office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did Donald Trump do more to fuck up the country than Gerald Ford? I don't think so. But, you know, he's a problematic figure in office. I'm not one of those people that's
no, of course,
bring him back in for another term. But it feels like kayfabe, man.
Mm.
When you see these elections roll out, I was talking with Gene Bajlan today. I was like, Israel's going to stop at a certain point. Are people going to stop when they stop? It happened in 2014. Mm-hmm. It happened in 2018. Everybody stops when they stop. The election is going to come up, and then it's going to be the new popularity contest. If Trump gets the nomination in the GOP, if they roll Biden's raggedy old ass out there again, it'll be, do you want 4 more years of a decent party, or do you want 4 years of fascism? You know that's going to be the conversation.
Dude, even on that, I mean, like the liberals now, the new thing that they're up to is you should support Mussolini over Hitler. Right? You know, just taking the lesser evil argument to like it's. And honestly, I will tell them that is the world that you will get. That is the world that you will get. If that is like what your political position is on these kind of questions, that is the world that you will get. And I hope that is not what happens. But if those people continue being as influential as they are, that's the world that we're going to
go get. Make them read about fucking Italy, the fascist Italian turn, and how scary it was for people living there.
It's
have them read about Spain during that same time. Like Americans are so divorced from ideas of fascism. You know why? Because we can only see fascism as racism.
Mm. And as foreign, too, in fairness.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
Bessner kind of talks about this. That's a European mm-hmm. thing. And oh, it's so sad for those people, but we don't really see how these policies affected everybody in places like the South, for example.
I mean, that's what I always say to people during the fascism debate is like, we actually don't have time to jump into it, but I will just say really quick, you know, whenever people get really worried about like if you want to use that terminology to describe like the MAGA movement or whatever, I always say one of the biggest things I always try to remind people of is just saying that something is not necessarily like fascism doesn't necessarily mean that it's like good, right? I think like, you know, we have like a very horrifying right wing example, and that's like the Confederacy and then neo-Confederate thought. And I think that a lot of the things that we're seeing on the right today like mimic and mirror that much more, and that's horrifying.
He's not a Marxist, but he's a historian of fascism, and he mentions Jim Crow and the post Reconstruction period as like a proto fascism. And I do think we don't have that. Not to get into that whole typographical argument, but yeah.
I mean, all I'm saying is that like calling something like a neo-Confederate movement is just as damning to me as anything else. But Jason, I don't want us to expire time here. I wanted to make sure that before you go, you tell everybody you were a teenage anarchist at one time, and you have a little piece.
A little piece. It's like an extended essay we turned into a book. Can I tell you
something? Yes, please tell us about it.
Mm-hmm. I'd send that to my mother, you know, bless her soul. And I said, I have a book coming out. She goes, huh, what's it called? And I send her a picture of the cover. And her response is, and I quote, "Anarchist, I wouldn't say you were a teenage anarchist. I feel like you were an anarchist about 6 weeks out. And that's when I gave it to my mother.
You got to
put that in the book, right?
Yeah, I know. You need to have a baby. You need to have a baby picture in there somewhere.
That is from my mom, who might be showing up. Again, she's going through some chemo right now, so she's not doing all the best. But hopefully, she can make it out. My daughter will definitely be there. But I'm excited. We're doing a meet and greet. What I don't like doing, as you guys know, as you deal with me with live shows, I don't like doing stuff in traditional settings. I don't like doing anything traditionally. Mm-hmm. It is rock in me. And so I was talking with a friend about this idea, and he was like, dude, we'll just do it at where I'm at. And he has kind of a guitar shop because he fixes guitars from everyone from Gary Holt from Slayer.
Hell yeah.
Tim Armstrong from Rancid and Lars from Rancid. So he just fixes everybody's guitars. And he's a really good friend of mine. And he goes, you know, there's some dudes that are going to love this. And, you know, I know people from where I lived in this warehouse in West Oakland. Mm-hmm. And so we started sharing the essay because it's a mini book pamphlet, mini essay, about 24 pages, I think. And it literally talks about the cultures of deconstruction and the cultures of authenticity that work against each other to nullify any movement to the mainstream populace, which is kind of the way I feel about the contemporary left. which is why I wrote the piece, and I just used punk rock or hardcore punk to juxtapose it. And we're going to have some friends come out. Chris Contos, who's the original drummer of Attitude Adjustment and Machine Head, who's in Forbidden now. Craig LeCicero from Forbidden. He was in the death metal band Death, too. And Rick Hunold, one of the original guys from Exodus, is going to be there. That's just to name a few. I don't know who else is coming through.
And that's this Saturday?
That's this Saturday. Ben Burt, you know, I keep forgetting Ben. Ben's going to be there.
Yeah.
And because Ben looked at me when we were putting this together. I think he was still living here at the time. And he goes, you know, I can help out if you need. I was like, well, do you want to roll? Because Ben's going to introduce the whole thing, which I'm pretty stoked about.
Nice.
So we're all going to be in the Bay in Fairfield, California, in a really, really cool, dope, intimate environment. I did one show at my buddy's place. So if you remember a show I did where there was a bunch of guitars behind me, like a wall of guitars, but I didn't realize whose you were looking at. You were looking at all these rock star guitars, Faith No More guys, and all these other people. It's going to be there. And then the guys are going to be taking questions too. And these dudes have great stories. Part of what I do in This Is Revolution comes from living in this warehouse, picking these dudes' brains, talking to them about their life on the road and what it was like back then in the 80s and 90s. And it's going to be a fun ass time. It'll be liquor.
There we go.
Hey, Griscom, you'll appreciate this. Real barbecue.
Hell yeah.
So
you should stick a camera in Burgess's hand now that he's volunteering to help out. I think, you know, I can get some content from it too.
Oh, I didn't want to mention this because we're not live streaming it. We're not live streaming it, but we are recording everything.
Very nice.
And it's going to be set up for us to do this. You know, everybody's going to be set up for sound and multiple. I think Greg said there's going to be about four or five camera angles. So I'm stoked about everything. I'm super nervous, of course, because it's one thing to write something and put it out in the world and walk away. It's another thing to have to talk about it, but I wanted to make the environment as comfortable as possible. So I've said, let's bring some of the homies from the music world.
And, hell yeah.
Awesome.
Well, I wish I had money to fly you guys out, man.
Well, next time around. Well, folks, we have links below to Jason's Peace and Damage magazine, to the event this Saturday, and to pick up the book. Jason, as always, man, it's always a pleasure to hang out and talk with you, brother. We should do it again soon.
Yes. Well, I'm going to see you in real life soon when you nuptials.
Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Well, everybody, thank you so much for chilling with us. We'll be back in just a moment.
Yeah, great talking to Jason again. It's been a while.
Jason Miles. Yeah, no, it's always good chatting with him. People in the California area, I guess it's a big state, San Francisco, right? I think is where it is. People should
we should put that in the show notes.
Yeah, it is in the show notes already. To some people,
oh, cool.
Things done ahead of time.
There you go.
It's there. It's in the show notes, folks. The event, which is this Saturday, November 18th. It seems like it's going to be a lot of fun. So y'all should definitely come by and see Jason and the rest of the crew. Yeah, it's always good to chat with him.
Yeah.
It's always hard to keep structure with him, too. It's not his fault. It's just like we all like can chat for a while. I realized that watching that the second time and dropping in like the fascism conversation as we're wrapping things up is classic. Like,
right. Yeah, it sounds like a cool atmosphere, too, that they're going to have there.
Oh, yeah, the party for sure. Well, talking about cool atmospheres, Matt, you want to go over the post?
Candace Owens is on a journey, folks. We're going to get right into this over in the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning. She's on a journey about anti-Semitism and Israel, and she's look, what can definitely be said is she's a confused young woman. Nasty politics, certainly, I think, are apparent, but stupid also. in the sense of well, anyway, we'll get into this in the post game. patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Yeah, so come and join us there, and remember the Communist Manifesto Part 3 is up there as well. So if you want to get access to that, I mean, that was a lot of fun. I was really happy to one get it done, just because that was feeling like we could have done probably 4 more.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is good. Like, we thought the Communist Manifesto was going to be one of the shorter ones, and I feel like we need
the longest.
We just one. Need yeah. Like a we need like a Marxist paragraph if we're going to get through it in in one episode.
Some aphorisms.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you want something more, please join us at the postgame patreon.com/leftreckoning. Yeah, we got Candace Owens. We also got calls and questions from you, the lovely audience. So get those in as well. You can leave us a voicemail. The number is this. I'll give it to y'all now. But if you want to hear your voice and our answers, you got to sign up. patreon.com/leftreckoning. Voicemail is 1-940-289-7234. 1-940-289-7234. And we'll be over there in just a couple of minutes, folks. So, see you in a minute.
Peace.